Mr. Murray Lee relates.
So Jerry set up his headquarters for his operations and his training schools in Monopoly, but I decided that as the Italian campaign was obviously going to take some time to complete, and as our ideas about security had been projected to the other side of the lines, that it would be sensible for me to set up my security headquarters in Bari and keep it away from the operational side, which tended to attract rather a lot of attention, especially as people from Cairo, it was Force 133, I think, were also in Bari and using the same facilities, air facilities, that we were. They were, Force 133 was covering Albania, Yugoslavia, and Austria, whereas one special force was dealing entirely with Italy and giving some help, I think I'm right in saying, to southern France. Anyway, there was just the beginnings of a certain difference of opinion about security and operations taking place between me and Jerry Holdsworth. I think he had to get on with his job, which was dropping agents into northern Italy, and I had to get on with mine. And I wanted to try and make sure that if anybody got caught in northern Italy, we knew and could warn the operational section concerned of exactly who knew who and who was liable to talk about what after the statutory 48 hours of silence had been gone through, because whenever these agents were told, if you get caught, for God's sake, try and put up with anything that happens in the first 48 hours to give your comrades a chance of getting away and going to ground. And obviously some of them didn't last out 48 hours. It's not really funny when you're being dealt with by the Gestapo, and all sorts of things happen, and you can never tell how an individual is going to react. I couldn't tell how I would react if I had electric shocks put through me, if I had my toenails and fingernails dragged out with a pair of pliers, if I had my ankles broken over a wooden horse with an iron bar, or if I was strung upside down and whipped with steel rods. I don't know what I would do. You just don't know how you're going to react until it actually happens. And if you're a masochist, sort of chap who likes being whipped by and tied up in chains and being whipped by some girl he's going to bed with, you can probably stand that sort of pain very much longer than if you're an ordinary individual, because by the time the pain becomes unbearable, you're more or less unconscious, so you can't talk anyway. Anyway, I tried to develop this rather more sophisticated attitude towards security. And I also thought it was better that when I was interrogating prospective agents and recruits, that it should be done in Bari rather than down at Monopoly. So Bari was a sort of safe house as far as Monopoly was concerned. And so I agreed with Jerry. I think he was rather reluctant because I was under his command, let's face it, to have his main security man sitting up in Bari 30 miles away from his own operational headquarters. But by that time I managed to get Arthur Baird out from England, or very soon after we got there I got Arthur Baird out from England, and he was a captain at that time and eventually became a major, and he took over the physical security side of the operation in Monopoly, whereas I developed this rather more sophisticated aspect of security based in Bari. And in Bari, I had a young man who'd been in Malta for 18 months, a young captain in the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, who'd gone over with his unit to Salerno and had, he was described rather unkindly as not being very good under fire. And so he'd been returned to a depot for reposting. But while he'd been in Malta for 18 months, living off rats and being bombed all the time, he'd spent the time learning Italian. Now, not only had he did he speak absolutely perfect Italian without any accent at all, but he had also studied all the regional accents in Italy, and he could tell when he was talking to an Italian whether the chap came from Bologna or Naples or the Alto Adige or Val d'Aosta or Milano or Torino. He knew all the accents. How on earth he achieved this in Malta, I do not know. He was just one of these brilliant natural linguists. He also played the piano extremely well. He was very good in French and German as well. He was a Barclays Bank clerk, I think, somewhere in Putney before the war. Anyway, he was a captain in the Royal Welsh Fusiliers, and the people who have a black flash on their collars at the back, some historical thing. This chap was presented to me, and I took him on as my interrogator, because I didn't speak Italian at the time. My Italian didn't get going until much later. And I also had a chap called Pat Gubbins, who was no relation of the Brigadier or of Michael. Pat Gubbins' background was Argentinian, I think, and he was also very fluent in Italian. So I had these two characters who did the interrogations of all the prospective agents that we picked up. Of course, you've got to remember there was complete chaos in Italy after they changed sides. I think it's true to say that it was pretty easy to spot a fascist or an ex-fascist. That was not difficult.
How?
Well, you get a sort of sixth sense about these things, and when you've got two men like my two interrogators who really did know the form and knew Italians, when you're talking to somebody and you're going through all their details and their history and all that sort of stuff, if you're kind to people, it's extraordinary how easily they give themselves away. And we could spot it straight away whether they were a good risk or a bad risk. I drew up a questionnaire for these interrogators of mine to work on. We used to call it the 33 points. It was all about their ancestry and where they were on such and such a time and what did they do. You know, but the time they'd, if they could answer all these questions, you had a pretty good picture of what they were. And in answering the questions, you could tell when they started to hesitate whether they were trying to make up something or not. Again, thinking back over 40 years, it's difficult to pinpoint the reasons why we would have had any one of the 33 questions down there, but the whole thing was very carefully worked out by the three of us. And we had all these agents through for screening before they went down to Monopoly into the what we call the country section. So my setup in Bari, I called 300 field security section. I suppose I must have had authority for using that particular number. Although when I went down to the Intelligence Corps depot the other day, they were very interested in this because they'd never heard of 300 field security section, and they're now trying to find out if there's any record of it. Because again, all these records were destroyed after the war. But we thought that it would be quite a good cover for us to call ourselves 300 Field Security Section. It had no war establishment, so we could have as many people as we wanted on the strength that we could get. And we set up this section in a requisitioned house in Bari, and we also had a flat where we all lived. We'd taken that off a German who'd had to leave in rather a hurry, and the place is absolutely stuffed full of scent. And there was one Ottoman there with it was literally full of most expensive perfumes. So all our girlfriends had a wonderful time. They thought we were marvellous because we used to dish these things out. And I remember one or two people came out from London, and a peer of the realm was down on his knees going through this stuff one day when he came to have dinner with us. He's a very nice man. Again, we mustn't mention any names. And so October in the winter of 1943 passed by. We came incredibly busy. I used to go down to Monopoly a great deal, where I'd installed Arthur Baird, and I got a feeling that Geoffrey Holland was also involved there. Because again, we had the same business of NCOs being with the agents who were being trained, doing exactly the same sort of work that they'd been doing in England, accompanying them all through the training to try and sort out the chaff from the corn on the security side. They had a very big radio operation going in Monopoly as well. I remember one night I was down there having dinner, and all of a sudden there was the most almighty explosion, and we thought that somebody had got in and had a go at our ammunition dump, because we had a lot of things that went off pop if we weren't very careful, but not a bit of it. When we went outside, we could see fires burning towards Bari, because I'd got two or three fannies up in Bari in a flat there. So I got on my motorbike and went back to Bari, and that was the night when two Messerschmitts had come in from the east across the Adriatic, almost at ground level. And they were flying into the setting sun. It sets in the west, doesn't it? That's right. And there were 15 ships in the harbour with an ammunition ship at each end. And these Messerschmitts got both the ammunition ships. They went off with a terrific bang, which was the explosion that we heard. And it sunk all the ensuing fire sunk all the other ships in the harbour. And it shattered practically every window in Bari, this explosion. When I got back, my fannies were sweeping up the glass in the flat. But otherwise, there was no damage. We were in Bari until Rome was safely liberated. But prior to that, I'd been over to Naples once or twice to have a look at our outstation there. And of course, this was where Michael Gubbins and they were Malcolm Munter and Michael Gubbins and Max Salvadori, who was an Italo-American, and the one of the leading lights in the Partito d'Azione, had their base in Capri, because Malcolm Munter had helped to liberate Capri and make quite sure that his father's house, San Michele, was not taken over by the Americans. And from Capri, they'd gone across in a small boat one night and rescued Benedetto Croce, who was a very well-known Italian philosopher, from his villa at Amalfi or Sorrento. And they operated from Capri, and when the Anzio landings took place, Malcolm and Michael and Max were supposed to go into the Anzio bridgehead, to find a way through the German lines to Rome, because we got a whole lot of our radio sets had gone off the air, and we'd lost communication with our agents in and around Rome, and they wanted to try and find a route through the German lines so that we could make contact with the agents again, get some more radio sets to them. Max developed jaundice on the night before he was they were supposed to go in, so he was taken off the operation. And Malcolm and Michael went in, and when they were in a slit trench during a bombardment, Michael got a direct hit from a mortar, and Malcolm was terribly badly wounded. And I haven't seen him since then, but I used to go over to Naples to, we had this outstation there, which had been moved from Capri by that time. It was very rough riding. All the bridges had been blown between Bari and Naples. Going over the Apennines was pretty hairy activity, because you had to go down into the gullies and cross the streams up the other side. The engineers had done a marvellous job in getting any sort of road we were going, but it took hours getting there. And we were running around in requisitioned Italian Fiats, civilian cars. I'd got a Milicento, marvellous car, but one day when we were on our way to Naples, we threw a big end and managed to find our way into Campo Basso, and where we found the Italians are absolutely marvellous engineers. And one of these little garage mechanics just made a new big end for this car while we waited. Quite extraordinary, we were able to go on to Naples. Of course, while we were in Bari all through this period, I got to know all the Cairo end, because Joy Lloyd, who'd been my secretary in London, had gone out to, and Marguerite Leppard had both gone out to Cairo, and they'd come over to Monopoly with Joyce Murchie and a whole gang of them, and this marvellous girl, Nina Tamplin, who'd made her way all the way from Riga to in Latvia to Jerusalem. It's quite a long way there, you know, when you look at it on the map. If you remember, Latvia was occupied by the Germans to begin with, and then eventually the Russians took over. And Nina's husband, she was Latvian, her husband was a chap called Guy Tamplin, who was running Hambro's Bank in Riga before the war. He'd had to leave in a hurry when the Germans took over. And in the meantime, had been posted out to SOE in Cairo. So Nina was left on her own in Riga. And the Russians took over, and she took a very dim view of this, and she made her way by herself all the way from Riga to Jerusalem. And when she got to Jerusalem, she walked into the King David's Hotel, and the first person she saw was her husband, who was up on leave from Cairo. Quite remarkable. So he took her down to Cairo, and where he had a fairly senior job in SOE. But some months later, he had a heart attack and died. Just bang, like that. He was quite young. So Nina, as a widowed Anglo-Latvian, was befriended by three colonels. There was, I think, Peter McMullen and Bill Harcourt and who was the other one? Oh, Marcus Seif. That's right, Marcus Seif. He's the chap who runs Marks and Spencer's now. Lord Seif he is now. He was a colonel then. And these three colonels undertook to look after Nina for the rest of the war. And they brought her over to Bari with Force 133 and all this clutch of fannies who were dealing with Albania and Yugoslavia and Austria and a bit of Greece too. And of course this was at the time when Tito was really coming into his own. And Fitzroy Maclean and Randolph Churchill were going in and out like yo-yos into Yugoslavia, Billy Maclean into Albania, and Anthony Quayle, he was in Albania too. And when these characters used to come out for 48 hours leave from their activities, because there was, at that time, we were running a pretty extensive air service into Yugoslavia, because large chunks of Yugoslavia had been was under the control of Tito. And I remember once we had one tremendous party in the Imperiale Hotel in Bari, when Randolph Churchill and Fitzroy Maclean had come out, and I'm not sure that Bill Deakin might have been there too, and Vivian Street. But I remember as the party really got going, Nina Templing got, we were all on a very long table, about, I suppose, 10 or 15 of us each side, and Nina got up at one end, and she did a sort of Cossack dance all down the table, kicking the glasses off with her left and right foot alternately. It was a tremendous mess. It was a wonderful performance. Somebody must have been playing a piano or something. But those were gay days, interspersed with tremendous hard work. And then, of course, as the... I remember when we were first in Bari, there was absolutely nothing between us and the Germans 100 miles north. And I remember Jerry and I were wondering what the hell we would do if the Germans suddenly had a push down the eastern coast of Italy, because there was absolutely nothing there. I mean, just a few sort of frontline troops, a sort of screen, but there was no real defence in depth. But the Germans were busily withdrawing up to somewhere north of Foggia, and very soon after we were in Bari, the enough troops came in to secure the eastern part of Italy down there in Puglia. Rome was liberated in beginning of June 1944, and I moved my office up to Rome within 7 days of it being liberated. We were very anxious to get to Rome because there were so many of our agents had managed to get into the Vatican before the liberation, the ones that were on the run, tremendous number of prisoners of war. And also, we very soon discovered that as soon as Rome was liberated and the Pope allowed all our chaps out, that an equivalent number of Germans, including the head of the Roman SS, I think his name was Dolman, I think it was, took their place in the Vatican. And so I was very keen to have a word with one or two of these people. It was this... One of my interrogators, this chap, the one who spoke Italian, Peter something, was a very staunch Roman Catholic, because the Jesuits had got him when he was 16. And if a chap becomes a proselyte age 16, he really does believe in the concept of the Immaculate Conception and all that sort of stuff, with all those dogmas which Church of England found rather difficult to stomach. And so he was, within no time at all, he got in touch with a Monsignore in the Vatican, Peter Cooper, that's right, Peter Cooper was his name, Monsignore in the Vatican. And one day he came to me in my office, and I had an office in the Via Boncompagni, just off of Via Veneto. It used to belong to the Ministry of Popular Culture. It's Mussolini's cultural thing. And Peter came into me one day and he said, would you like to meet the Pope? I couldn't believe my ears. And I said, yes, I'd love to. He said, well, I said, how have you arranged that? He said, well, my Monsignore friend is a great friend of the Pope. I think this was Pius the 11th. He was, before he was the Pope, he was Cardinal Pacini, and had been the papal nuncio in Berlin when Hitler had really come to power. And he had a slightly unsavory reputation, I remember, in our intelligence world.
In what way?
Well, we reckoned that he hadn't really done enough to combat Nazism, and he'd sucked up to the Pope, sucked up to Hitler too much, and had done very little to try and control the obvious excesses of the Nazi party. It's particularly against the Roman Catholics. But this was our information. I may have been all wrong, as far as I know. But anyway, Peter said that his Monsignore friend was a great friend of the Pope's and could easily arrange a private audience for him. And of course, for Peter to meet the representative of God on earth was really quite something. So I said, yes, I'd love to. I said, I don't know how you can get me. He said, well, the Monsignore said, I can take a friend. So it was arranged that we would go down and have an interview with the Pope. I had an ulterior motive. I went and bought myself a crucifix and a rosary because it's the thing to do to take something and have it blessed by the Pope when you go, no matter what religion you are. And so Peter and I went down one morning, and we were marched into the Vatican and taken into the anteroom. We went through that marvellous room where all the cardinals were ordained. It's plastered in gold. Beautiful. I think the inside of St. Peter's is one of the most spectacular things that I've ever seen in my life. And I remember being so struck by the magnificent opulence of the inside of the Vatican and the appalling poverty and the squalor immediately outside the doors in Trastevere. It's quite incongruous. But anyway, we went all the way through these private apartments to the private apartment of the Pope, and the audience rooms are a series of fairly large cubicles. What's this room? 12 by 12, is it? Something like that. 10 by 10, perhaps. So these rooms would be about 15 by 15, beautifully furnished, open on one side. There's this long passage, about, as far as I remember, about five or six audience rooms. And right at the head of this series of audience rooms is another private room in which the Pope receives the crowned heads of states and the really sort of top people who come to see him, whereas all the lesser people who have audiences that go into the other rooms. And to our astonishment, Peter and I were wheeled into this room where the crowned heads of states were received. And Cardinal Pacini came in, and we had 20 minutes with him. We had to kneel down and we were blessed, and I got this rosary blessed and all this. Peter Cooper, in the meantime, was absolutely... he was so white and shaking at meeting God on earth that before we went in, I tried to cheer him up a bit. And I said, it's jolly good of the Pope to receive somebody of the Church of England. And he was in such a state of excitement that he said, how dare you say anything like that? I belong to the Church of England, you don't. Anyway, we had 20 minutes with him, and I probed around, and I said, any chance of having a word with Mr. Dolman? And Pope said, he was very tactful, he said, you must realize that we have no politics in the Vatican, and we will always help anybody who is in trouble. And only 1 month ago, there were a considerable number of your friends who were in trouble, who were in the Vatican, and we looked after them. And now we are having to look after a lot of other people who are in trouble. Of course, they were all on their way to South America. So that was quite an interesting thing. Then we were really, so summer 44... The Rome Opera was got going in the winter. I was heavily involved with my men were heavily involved with interrogating an arcade index of information about Italians who were working for us and against us in north of the line was really getting enormous. I think by the end of the war, there was something like 40,000 cards on my index of aliases,